I'm Jim Eldringham. This is My Crummy Little Podcast. I'm joined this week by Jeff Wolliner. He's the founder of Winning Wit, and he helps people inject humor and engaging storytelling into their otherwise dreary, boring little speeches, presentations, toasts. Jeff, thanks for joining this crummy little podcast.
Great to be here. I love a good crummy podcast.
But it actually is going to be pretty good because you're here today. And hey, thank you for joining me today. I know it's the first day of Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah to you and your family.
I appreciate that. And happy Hanukkah to any Jews you may know. So.
I know I've been talking to friends of mine who celebrate Christmas, and every year we talk about how it's too commercial. You feel the same way about Hanukkah?
No, because it's you can't take something that's pretty minor to begin with and make it too commercial, So it's not a very big deal to begin with. You know, it's interesting you mentioned how Hanukkah really has taken this almost a grip on the imagination of American Jews in a way that had never happened in world history. As you mentioned before, it's a very minor holiday in the pantheon of things. First of all, it's not a religious holiday at all. It's a historical footnote. It was, you know, it's a great battle. You know, particularly, you know, Jews coming over from Europe in the late 19th century, early 20th centuries, it was interesting because the first generation that came over were really, really religious. A lot of the folks you see today, like, you know, the long sideburns and black hats and all that, but their kids were desperate to become Americans and desperate to assimilate, and they did so very quickly. But one of the ways to do that was you don't want to be that guy on Christmas. You know, the opening scene in Ted, like the Jewish kid, they all run out and beat him up. Yeah, take that, you Joe bastard. You know, beat him down. And it's like, that was really the experience early on. So they figured, okay, we can't co-opt it. We can't make it our holiday. It's not our holiday, even though it's about the birth of a Jew. The songs were written by Jews. The movies were directed by Jews. It's not our holiday, so we have to take something that's at least within the, kind of the calendar area of it. And they landed on Hanukkah. So he said, okay, well, it's a cool story about a bunch of Greeks that got together one day and said, this is Sparta! And then they marched on Israel. And then, you know, the Jewish governor of Israel said, wait a second now. Okay, first of all, I'm going to slap them with an injunction for trespassing. You can't allow this. And then second of all, I'm going to call my brother on the Jerusalem City Council, and we're going to disrupt their supply lines by finding that diner that's giving them all the good stuff and getting it shut down for health code violations. So that's pretty much how it went down.
And that, kids, is the Hanukkah story.
That's the Hanukkah story. But, you know, again, it was just one of those things where, you know, you sat around, you lit some candles, and even then, candlelighting wasn't a very big thing until – it became kind of synonymous with, like, the Jewish Christmas tree. So you light the Hanukkah candle, and then, you know, you got your Hanukkah Harry. I don't know where the Hanukkah Harry thing came up with. Somebody must have been stoned one day at Berkeley and came up with that. That's preposterous. But
now, is that – that's from SNL, right?
I think so, yeah. It was – and then it just became a thing.
Yeah, because it was the night Hanukkah saves Christmas. Hanukkah Harry went around, took over Santa's route for him. That was the first time I heard of it. I don't know if that's, like, 1989. I don't know if there was a – I mean, I guess we'll have to get some Jewish scholars go down to the temple or something like that and see if anybody knows of a reference to Hanukkah Harry.
And then, you know, of course they figured, okay, well, you know, now we have the Hanukkah thing, so we have to do presents too. We don't have a tree, so let's just do one better. Let's just do 8 gifts. The problem is it ended up being like 8 crappy gifts instead of one awesome Christmas gift. So you're not making up for in volume what you're losing out in quality. You know, it's like a pair of socks here, a pair of underwear here, a noogie from grandma. Like, we're not talking good stuff. Nothing like you're going to Rochambeau over in school.
The equation doesn't work out at all. Doesn't balance.
Not particularly. It's like, yeah, instead of giving you $1 million, I'm going to give you like 8 ones. You get 8 gifts instead of a one-time check. You're the lucky one. Yeah, so it wasn't really wasn't all that was cracked up to be. Holiday parties are nowhere near as fun as the Christmas parties. There's no, like, the Yuletide and mistletoe, and no one's spiking the eggnog. All you're hearing is, like, Uncle Murray talk about his, you know, trip to the gastroenterologist. It's no good. So,
do you just kind of, like, find yourself showing up at other folks' Christmas parties or,
Absolutely. I'm the biggest Christmas Jew in the world. And, I mean, a lot of that, too, is because, you know, I come from a mixed family, and my mother's family, a lot of them are Italian, so – kind of the pizza bagel dynamic gives you access.
I wouldn't have figured that, by the way.
Yeah, nobody ever does.
Good, And they couldn't see any Italian in that in the water mix.
You know, and it's funny getting a room full of Italians and Jews together during the holidays. You get a whole bunch of ophthalmologists who didn't see nothing. See, I screwed up my own joke. I didn't.
Right down
here, I'm telling you. But yes, I was exposed to both of it. So I'd go to the Christmas parties that my uncle Al would host down in Staten Island, and it was your classic Italian Christmas and big and boisterous, and everyone doing each other up, and giving the 8-year-old scotch. It's a good time, So that wasn't a joke, by the way. That was the thing. And that's actually how I, believe it or not, was where I first started the whole idea of me becoming a comedian when I was a kid there. And they gave me a little shot, and I went up there and I roasted my grandfather. It wasn't an elaborate routine. I mean, we're talking like a good 5 minutes just kind of making fun of his flatulence. So that was really the whole thing there.
Now, I mentioned before, you guys are winning wit. You guys are killing it right now. You're helping people inject humor, inject storytelling into their speeches. We're getting into peak speech season in New Hampshire, in Iowa, in South Carolina, probably a little bit in Florida, too. As you're watching the early process, though, are you seeing anybody who's doing a good job working that in? It's tough to be funny.
It's very tough to be funny. And, we certainly have a keen eye toward it, but, unfortunately right now, I'm just not seeing it. I'm certainly not seeing it on the Democrat side. I mean, it's funny because their candidates purport to be everything that their base isn't. And yet they're out there, and they're stodgy, and they're throwing out 40-year-old ideas, and there's no humor associated with it. And what's interesting about this cycle is that there's no humor because there's just an angry tone in the electorate. There's an angry tone amongst the candidates. It's a different kind of beast this year.
Now, do you think then the humorless delivery is needed? Do you think it's something that voters want here? Do you think if they have someone coming out and being a little bit more lighthearted that they're not going to respond to it?
We haven't found that, in our business. We find people want more humor. They want more levity. Humor and levity tend to be most popular amongst populations that are downtrodden, amongst countries that are going through difficult times. The two greatest populations in the world that have ever come out with the sharpest, most witty humor have been the Irish and the Jews, and the fact that they both experienced a tremendous amount of adversity. They haven't done it in spite of it; they've done it because of it. So I think where the country is right now, there's a need and a want. But you look out at the candidates there; they don't have, at least to my knowledge, anybody internally that's really making a point of getting that tone across, getting that levity across. And I think they could. And I think the one that does it is going to absolutely leap ahead of the pack by leaps and bounds, regardless of the message.
Yeah, and it's not an easy thing to inject humor. We saw a few weeks ago, Hillary Clinton's team came out, I guess it's a couple months ago now, saying you're going to see a newer, funnier Hillary Clinton. You can't come out and say, okay, folks, I'm going to be funny now, and then expect people to start laughing.
There's no way. What you have to do is get to work it in. And you have to work it in with formulaic comedy, things like the old bait and switch and things like run-ons where you inject something preposterous in there at the end and see if anybody's paying attention. There's a lot of ways to do it, and with the right writers on their team, hint, hint, wink, plug, you can accomplish that. But a lot of them, I think, don't want to do it. And, it's interesting where we're moving away from that great kind of subtle humor from almost the British tradition and more into the Howard Sternish shock jock. If you want to get attention, you just be Trump and say, they're stupid. And that just gets a laugh. I mean, it's absolute lowest common denominator. I mean, it's almost like the the Dane Cook level of comedy has injected itself into the presidential race. And for all of us purists out there, it was a dark time.
Speaking of content theft, now that's kind of an interesting observation as far as the more subtle British version of humor versus the beat you over the head humor. I was actually thinking about this watching an old episode of The Simpsons, which had subtle visual sight gags and some throwaway lines that were kind of off the cuff, versus now you go back and watch some of those episodes, you're like, there's some hidden humor there that you didn't even see.
Yep.
Versus you look at a show like Family Guy, which is in the same tradition in that it's a cartoon, it's almost a spoof of the traditional sitcom, but it's a completely different type of humor, at least in terms of its delivery.
Completely. And it's much more of the beat you over the head type. Now, I say this as a guy who thinks it's, a lot of it's absolutely brilliant and really, really, really funny.
Sure.
Because a lot of the time they push the envelope, I think for the sake of pushing the envelope. And I respect they do that on a major network. I don't think a lot of other people have the guts to do that. So a hat for them for all that. Seth MacFarlane's a guy who's made a living pushing the envelope and being as edgy as possible. But you're right, it's different, and we've gone away from that. The Simpsons was one of the most brilliant shows, I think, in the history of not only TV, but of cinema and of the playwright tradition. Absolutely tremendous.
Is it something that, if you're a presidential candidate, it's almost better to not try than to try and get it wrong? Or is it better to just kind of go out there, throw stuff against the wall, see what sticks?
You can. The thing about comedy is that you can try and you can get it wrong, but you have to recover and then self-deprecate immediately after it goes wrong. You can't just look at the audience and they don't get the joke and just stare at them until they get it. It's not going to work that way. Some comedians do that and it's a disaster, and some presidential candidates do it. And you've seen it happen over the course of time with some candidates, and they made some jokes and it hasn't gone over, and then it's a weird, uncomfortable look. And I mean, you know, let's not kid ourselves over here. A lot of these guys are Connecticut in a suit. So at the end of the day, they don't have what it takes to just do that. But I think with the right coaching and the right study and the right dedication to it, they can. And that's really the point where I think a lot of them can jump into this, is they're not personable people, a lot of them. They really aren't. But if they just inject just a little bit, just enough to throw them off, it's like a team, it's like a football team that's known as a pound-the-rock kind of team. You're going to line up 3 yards in a cloud of dust. But once in a great blue moon, you suck in the defense, you just go way over the top, and there's nobody covering downfield. That's how you run an offense. That's how you win, and that's how you communicate effectively. You give them just enough to keep them on balance. And that's the real value of humor in a presidential campaign.
Now, you mentioned the Democratic side. Who have you seen? What have you seen on the Republican side? And
you know, there's only one that really jumps out at me, and that's Ben Carson. And if you recall during the debate, it was a couple of months back, where he dropped that great line, and I wish I committed it to memory. And I'm going to go back and watch it on YouTube. But about him being the only brain surgeon up there, and how other people need brain surgery, something along those lines. It was his closing line during the debate. And it absolutely brought down the house. It was a killer, killer line. And it just opened up a whole new side to a very soft-spoken, serious guy that people didn't even know really existed. So I think that was great, and it helped his favorability ratings. I mean, people looked at it afterwards and said, well, we actually have a personality on this animated corpse that is Dr. Ben Carson. So it was exciting. And, you know, again, Trump is not funny. He's not witty. He says things for shock value, which, as somebody who's easily impressed, I find it funny, but I can understand why others would. I haven't seen it out of Cruz. I haven't seen it out of Rubio. I certainly haven't seen it out of Christie. So I'm not really seeing it in the rest of the field.
I kind of handsome danged you there for a second while you were answering that question. The line was, the only one from Ben Carson in his closing remarks in the first debate, I'm the only one to take out half a brain, although you would think if you go to Washington that someone had beaten me to it. That's the line.
That's a great line.
Which is pretty good.
And I think that just underscores the point that if you can have that perfectly well-placed line, and it's really funny, and it throws people off because the conversation was so heavy and so serious, and as they are, because you know, some cycles, things are a little bit less serious. You know, when Clinton's running for re-election in 96, we're not having mass shooters on American soil. You know, we're not having these troubles abroad. It's a fairly tranquil time. So the entire campaign was Norm Macdonald as Bob Dole in the real world. I mean, that was it. That was the gravity of that campaign. It's a different world now. It's a tougher world now. So you're going to have a tougher tenor, which is why I think humor now will be even more effective, because it completely pulls a rug out from under people and just, okay, we can laugh. We're not all going to die tomorrow. That's awesome.
Hey, so switching gears, it's not just getting to be peak political season, but we've got the, you know, the holidays from Thanksgiving through New Year's is peak proposal season. A lot of folks, a lot of guys getting down on one knee. A lot of engagements are starting, which means a lot of weddings are going to start being planned, which means a lot of folks are getting calls now saying, hey, you're my best man. Hey, you're my maid of honor. I'm going to need you to give a toast at the reception. I know this is a big thing for you guys at Winning Wit, that you guys do a lot of helping people out with with Wedding Toast. So without giving away the store, any tips?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, as for best man speeches and maid of honor speeches, if you want to, you guys want to check it out on Etsy. We actually have a whole series that we just published out there. As far as the full guide, the comprehensive Bible for a best man speech and maid of honor speech, and it really goes through all the main things. And there's a lot of moving parts to it. People think you just get up there, you grab the mic, you say a few words, and you go home. But the reality is, if you make a great speech at a wedding, a truly great speech, people are going to talk about it for years. You know, I can't tell you how many weddings I've been to where people are still talking about an amazing speech that was given maybe a decade or 15 years ago. It makes an impression. So a couple things you want to do. First and foremost, you want to get yourself right mentally before the game. You know, and we always call it the game because you're getting up there. It's a performance. You're going to be up in front of people. You're going to be doing your thing. So have a day of you. You know, go out there, eat your favorite food, watch your favorite movie, hang out with your favorite people, call your favorite person. Get your mind right. Get de-stress by just having 24 hours of complete self-indulgence. You have my permission. You have your Uncle Jeff's permission to go out there and have a scotch and a steak and do whatever makes you happy. Because by doing that, you're going to de-stress. You're going to get in that right frame of mind. You also want to create moments with people in the crowd. You know, the worst kind of speech involves somebody getting up there and just kind of scattergunning and looking around the room and, you know, not knowing what they're saying or where they're saying it to. Tell a story up there. Start with when you first met the person. You know, so, you know, Jill and I first met when we were in elementary school. And, you know, then we moved up through middle school. And then this is where she met the love of her life. And I'll never forget the first time I met. So tell a chronological story about when you first met the person to now. And while you're telling that story, whenever you bring somebody's name into it, pivot and look at that person in the crowd. So, you know, Thanksgiving at Aunt Mildred's was an incredible time. And then you look at Aunt Mildred. By the way, is anybody still named Mildred anymore? Or is this like 1960? But, yeah.
We're going to bail out of Mildred.
I think we're like appealing to the Mildred demographic here. But
everyone's talking about the honeybee problem, but Mildred problem may be worse.
It kind of strikes me as the honeybee problem is something Mildred would talk about. I think we have some synergy there. But that's the thing. You want to create moments with people in the crowd. So when you mention the name of somebody who's in the crowd, that's part of your speech, pivot, look at them, hold that moment with them. Gaze with them. And by doing that, you're going to have the whole crowd become part of that moment with you. So any great speech is about moments. And then you want, like anything else, you want a confident body posture. You want to go up there, you know, looking like a boss, commanding the room. And then you don't want to get too far off topic. You know, don't make this a personal stand-up routine. Don't talk about the peanuts on the plane or any of that nonsense that you came in there. Just stick to the content. And then when it's all said and done, finish with your best joke. Whatever that best joke may be, finish with it, leave them laughing. Thank you, good night, okay. George Costanza style. Oh, that's it for me, and just walk away. So. Those are really the keys to making a truly great and memorable wedding speech.
Well, on that note, that's Jeff Wollner. He's the founder of Winning Wit, who helped people inject humor, storytelling into their speeches, into presentations, into their wedding toasts. You can find them at winningwit.com. Jeff, thank you very much for joining this crummy little podcast.
I appreciate your time, Jim, as always. Merry Christmas to you and the family.
Yes, and hey, happy Hanukkah to you and your wife as well.
Thank you. Perhaps you'll see the light, and I'll wish you a happy Hanukkah next year, my friend.
Thanks for listening this and every week. You can follow the Crummy Little Podcast online at crummylittlepodcast.com. You can find us on iTunes, subscribe, and leave a review. And you can, of course, follow me on Twitter at Jim Eltringham. Thanks again for listening in.